Session number 20612, Reel 2.
Bob Collins, Reel 2.
Yes, we're no longer Reel in the Royal Navy because merchant seamen were civilians, in fact. If they had to call at neutral ports, for instance, they were civilians. So we became civilians. I was, in fact, classified as a deckhand.
What exactly was your job in the Empire Lawrence?
A radar operator. But as I say, the radar equipment it wasn't very proficient, and quite often it broke down. The radar control was handed over to the Ocean Voice, which was a Commodore ship, which was better equipped with radar. So mainly my job was, with the gunners, which we also carried. And I used to fill up oilskin pans with three ball and one tracer. Always remember that. Those, so you could find them hose pipe fashion. So I spent more time with the gunners than I did with the radar.
What exactly was the problem with the radar equipment?
Well, I think it was lack of an experience, really. We carried one technician who was on a par with most of us. He'd come out training, you know, so he had no vast experience of radar at all. Just pulled the valves out, replaced them, that sort of thing. Maybe it worked again, but that was a lack of experience, really. So we had very little training in actual radar operating, but that wasn't the difficult part at all. It's just that it didn't work. I don't know if you ever saw a radar screen in those days. It was like a oscilloscope with just a little trace on it, and you had to, and if this trace appeared, something appeared above this trace, it was an aircraft, and then you were able, if you were efficient enough, to count the number of spikes on this pip sort of thing, then you could say, estimate roughly how many aircraft there were. So I mean, we became more efficient out in the Pacific and the Indian Ocean, where I was a proper radar. Even then, though, I finished up on the guns, but that's another story. But so anyway, I was most of the time was spent on a ship was during action stations. Was working with the gunners, oilskin gunner.
But did you get the radar to work at all on Empire Lawrence?
It worked occasionally. It just depends on, well, if this radar technician, mechanic, was able to identify a valve which wasn't lit, for instance, and he replaced that valve, it might work, but perhaps it would be something else gone wrong, a resistor burnt out, or capacitor gone, or all sorts of things. So it wasn't very efficient at all. So most of the time we got the message, Ocean Voice will now take over the radio, because we'd reported failings with the radar. They'd picked up aircraft where we hadn't, for instance. So we were in contact with the Ocean Voice, and they would say, have you got any bearing, any sights? And you'd say, no, but they had sites. They said, check on bearing such and such a thing. And there would be nothing there. So our radar wasn't working, or it wouldn't work efficiently. Radar was in its infancy in those days, not very good at all. But anyway, there it was.
And where was the Oerlikon gun which you were working on?
Well, there were, I can't remember how many there were. There were four on the bridge, I think. Or two Oerlikons and some Marlins, I think, a First World War machine gun type thing. Utterly useless, absolutely useless. We had a 4-inch, or I think it was a 4-inch aft. Yeah, aft. That was high angle, but not all merchant ships, they had either high angle or low angle guns. So low angle, obviously, you couldn't fire an aircraft, but you could shoot at submarines. They had high angle guns, they couldn't depress low enough to fire at submarines anyway. So we didn't have a lot of choice. All in all, I think merchant ship defence was futile, useless against any attack, be it submarine or aircraft. I mean, I've only realised this since, of course, you know, how futile that defence was for merchant ships. The system, the convoy system itself, was consisted of the speed of the slowest ship. That seemed logical to me. It didn't occur to me at the time. I knew about it, but since then I realised, well, why didn't they take the slowest ship out of the convoy? You would still have a slower ship, but at least it'd be a little bit faster. So we were reduced to 8 knots, I think it was. The convoy was reduced to 8 knots. Because, I can't remember which ship it was, but one of them could only do 8 knots. Generally they were 10, 12 knots. But of course they couldn't do that speed.
Do you know the name of the convoy that you were in?
Oh yeah. PQ-16.
So let's pick up the story from the assembling of the convoy at Iceland, please.
Well, we sailed with, I think, 35 ships, 35 merchant ships. And we went out with a huge escort. There was American battleships, Wichita, I think, cruiser Tuscaloosa, Washington, plus London, Norfolk, several cruisers, plus their escort, destroyer escort. So we had nothing here at all. But that didn't quite work out that way, because 2 or 3 days, I think 3 days out of Iceland, we had one of the Blommenfoss Focke-Wulf Condor reconnaissance plane picked us up, and that just flew around the convoy. And when destroyers or escorts went after it, it just went a little farther out. So kept reporting our position, and then we got our first attack, and well, it was marvellous. So we were all driven off, no bother at all. But then of course the larger ships all scarving off, they went up north, farther north, as a covering force. And this left the convoy with, I think, 3 or 4 destroyers, some corvettes and armed trawlers. Pretty useless, really, as defence. One submarine we had, Polish submarine. So we were virtually defenceless, in my opinion, you know. But we never thought about that. Didn't think about that sort of thing in those days. It wasn't as though you felt invulnerable. It was just that, well, this was your life now, and this is what went with it, you accepted. You know? There was no worry. You didn't panic or worry about what was going to happen. I mean, as far as bombing experience was concerned, well, I was pretty well inured to that anyway. So when we had near misses, well, it was just a near miss. You know, I didn't realise at the time, of course, that a near miss could spring a plate sort of thing, result, which is what happened on the Illustrious. But anyway, so we just carried on. I think it was. We didn't get a lot of darkness at that time. This was in May, by the way. We didn't get a lot of darkness. I think at the most, I don't think there was any real darkness at all. So we didn't really know what time it was. And then eventually one day we got this. We'd flown off this aircraft, by the way. We had two RAF pilots aboard. And one was a Canadian, one was a New Zealander. And we flew off the Canadian. And he managed to shoot one plane down, damaged another, or something like that. And he's now got a ditch in the sea. So he does a victory roll over the ship. But unfortunately, the American ship behind us, it's a controversial, yeah, because some say it was the Carlton, but it wasn't the Carlton, because the Carlton had turned back to Iceland for some reason or other. Anyway, I think it was a Mourner. Anyway, I can't remember the name of the ship. Anyway, shot at him, thinking it was an enemy plane. And he got a bullet up his bum, in fact. But he ditched anyway, and he was picked up by the destroyer volunteer, which was an old V&W thing, coal-burning thing. And that was the last we saw him, in fact. Don't know what became of him. So shortly after, I don't know if it was the next day or the same day, we got a raid. Raids were fairly constant, as I say, but these were high-level bombers, because we weren't yet in range of Stukas and things yet. So these were high-level bombers, and we got, during one of these raids, one bomb inboard, and it went through number two hold. And I was on deck at the time, say, filling these Oerlikon pans. And I watched the mate sound the hold, and he shouted up to the bridge that she was going down, but quite slowly. And the skipper then sounded the klaxon and abandoned ship. Don't know if you know that. They yanked the klaxon, rope. A number of times, and this means you abandon ship, and it's also telling others that you are abandoning ship. So it was all quite casual. We were going down by the head quite slowly, so it was time to go back aft and put on some heavier gear, and pick up cigarettes and that sort of thing, you know, to get away in the boats. Well, we came back up on deck, and I was actually in a boat being lowered on the starboard side. That was my lifeboat station, and I was actually in a boat with others being lowered over the side, and these we were now in range of Stukas, and I saw these controversial. I saw four, but some say it was five. But certainly four of these bombs hit us and just blew us out of the water. And I'm facing it inboard, halfway down the ship in this boat. And I saw the ships blown into three separate pieces. And I don't know what happened after that. The next thing I recall is coming up to the surface. And I think, as far as I recall, it was just lots of bubbles. And I might have been in a bubble, I don't know. But anyway, I broke the surface. And I actually remember not just coming up to the surface, but coming up above the surface, as though perhaps there was an explosion underneath me. And it blew me out of the water. But then, of course, I'm now... quite, as I say, I don't know what happened between the actual ship blowing up and, say, between then and coming up to the surface. I don't know what happened, whether I went down with the ship or whether I was blown off the ship, or I just don't know. So now I thought, well, the first thing I've got to do, let's get these sea boots off. For some reason, I thought they might drag me down, you know, fill up with water and drag me down. So I kicked off these sea boots. Now, I'd already had some just talk sort of thing that these Kapok filled life jackets only lasted 48 hours. Now, when you think about it, it's utterly ridiculous to think that you're going to survive for 48 hours bobbing about in Arctic waters. But it never occurred to me. You know. So I thought, well, I've got to have something better than this life jacket. Now, I tried to get a big Arctic duffel coat off. Now, I got it over my shoulders, but I couldn't get it any farther. Because the Arctic duffel coat was a lot, it was sort of leather bound, and it was a real heavy thing. But anyway, I couldn't get it over my shoulder, so I thought, well, I've got to have something better than this life jacket. Oh, it's only going to last me 48 hours. So there were some bits of driftwood around, and I picked up one, and I just recall trying to climb onto it, and of course, it kept rolling over. And then there was another hatch baton or something that came by. So I now got one under this arm and one under the other arm. So I feel quite safe now. Now, I recall seeing the convoy now going ahead of us. And there was no sign of rescue ships. Well, rescue ships didn't exist as such in those days. I think the rescue ship as such came about on the next convoy, which was PQ-17. They'd learned lessons from PQ-16. So anyway, I'm bobbing about in the water there, and suddenly I see this, which turned out to be HM trawler Lady Madeline. She's hove to, and there are some men sort of just leaning on the rails. I found out afterwards they didn't expect to see any survivors, which was quite reasonable, because it's an Aegis sort of ship blow up. And anyway, I managed to attract their attention. I was the first one to be picked up, in fact, of the survivors. But all the rescue facilities that the Lady Madeline could offer was a little rowing boat with two men in it, one pulling and the other one steering. So within a very short time, I'm lying in the bottom of this boat and I could see this great sea boot on my hand. I couldn't feel a thing, so I was numb with the cold. They dragged me over the side in, and I lie in the bottom, but I came to, and they pulled in other fellas, because the boat now was unable, the seas weren't rough as such, but they were choppy, and they weren't able to get back to the Lady Madeline. But the Lady Madeline had obviously called up some assistance. Now there were survivors in the water, and HMS Hyderabad, which is a flower class, but it doesn't sound like a flower class, but it was a flower class, but it was to be HMS Dettol. But because the Nizam of Hyderabad had paid for the thing, they called it Hyderabad, but it was a flower class. So we were taken aboard this flower class Corvette.
How did you transfer to the Hyderabad?
From Lady Madeline's little rowing boat.
But how did you do it? How did you get up there?
How did you get onto the ship?
Yes.
Well, I suppose with a lot of assistance, because I was numb with cold. So it must have been a lot of assistance. But I don't recall it. All I recall is cutting off all the gear, all my clothes, and giving me a drink of something hot, which I think was Bovril or Oxo or something like that, and then wrapping me in blankets, taking me below, putting me in a bunk, and I must have gone straight off to sleep, I suppose, because... Well, I did. I went off to sleep. And when I woke up, they give me this little sack with some clothing in it, mostly things knitted by the WVS. Like there was a pair of long johns, there was balaclava, there were trousers that fit anybody, sort of. Carpet slippers, socks knitted by the WVS, and a jersey, you know, pullovers or type thing knitted by the WVS. And that was it. So all our naval, well, we didn't have naval uniforms on because, as I say, they were on a ship. So that was how we were dressed, and that was how we finished up in the Soviet Union. I'll now go up on the deck in time to see another ship sunk. I think it was the Empire Purcell, and the ship's crew rescued some of those survivors.
What did you see of the sinking of the Purcell? Empire Purcell.
What did I see of it? Well, I didn't actually see the bombs hit it. And she didn't sort of blow up at all. But they abandoned the ship and she sank. But I didn't actually see the thing sink, but it did sink. And the survivors were in the water, so the boats were upturned anyway. So we rescued those, then we carried on then until we went to Murmansk. Now there's quite a saga after that, because the skipper of this Hyderabad was an ex-trawler man. Now, I can understand why he did this. But he just, when we got into Murmansk, he immediately put us survivors, all the survivors, into the ship's boat, took us ashore and dumped us in Murmansk, or on the quay at Murmansk, and they went back to the ship. Now, I can understand why he did that. He's considering his own crew, and he picked up all these survivors, and he didn't have room, all the facilities, all the feeding for them. So he wanted to get rid of them as soon as he could. So he did this. He dumped us on the shore. Now, during the short time I was on the Empire Lawrence, I was able to pick up a little bit of Russian from a naval officer who got killed eventually with a ship, who was going to the Soviet Union as an interpreter. So he was able to teach us a smattering of Russian. So anyway, just milling around, bit of snow on the ground, and we got these carpet slippers on, bear in mind. no great coats or anything like that. And a Russian ambulance turned up, and we climb into this ambulance, and there's not all of us, only those who managed to scramble in first. And he takes us to, I presume, the hospital. But they wouldn't let us in, I presume only because we weren't injured. Nobody was injured. They come back. We're back on the quay. And now...
You mean the ambulance took you back to the quay?
Yeah. Yeah. An American, I should think he was a chief, a petty officer or something like that. He turns up on this quay with some more survivors, and he organised things. How he did it, I just don't know, but he realised the predicament we were in. So he now goes, he's got a boat, and he goes back to all the American ships that got into Murmansk, because some of the convoy went to Archangel. And he collected cigarettes and provisions, sort of thing, from the American ships, brought them back to the quay. And then, it must have been some hours later, we get into this boat and we go across the river to some empty huts, like army huts. And we're allocated by this. He was brilliant. I don't know who the hell he was, but he was absolutely brilliant. Now, it wasn't his job, obviously. He'd just done this on his own back, apparently. And he'd organised this, and he allocated us different huts. And all we had to do was keep the place clean and help around the thing, like collecting wood for the fire and helping in the cookhouse and that sort of thing. And anyway, it was quite pleasant, actually. We were opposite Murmansk, which was bombed almost 3 or 4 times a day. So we could see the bombing going on. But we were the other side of the river. But it was, we could walk up a hill from these barracks, and brilliant camouflage, because you couldn't see any guns. They were hidden in the ground. And this camp we were in was their barracks, in fact. But they moved up with their guns and dug pits out, and they lived with their guns. So we were in this Red Army camp, which they'd abandoned. Well, one day we're down on the little beach, several of us, and a naval pinnace goes by, and there's an officer in the stern on the tiller. And one of the fellas, who I know, says, "I recognise that officer." He says, "It's my old divisional officer on the Edinburgh." So he hails the boat, and the boat turns around and comes back. And sure enough, this is an officer from